Today, Australia's lifeboat to avoid RMS Trump. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, well, notice posts covering finance and property news. Today I'm joined by Robbie Barwick from the Citizens Party. Robbie Barwick, research director and Senate candidate, and working very hard. Hello, Robbie.
Hello, Martin. Wishing you were here.
Having fun yet?
Oh, well, it's apparently gets fun at some point. It's gone from, I'm looking forward to the 4th of May where we can go back to being flat out instead of hectic and manic on this election campaign. But I suppose that's what happens when you are serious about election races. So, yeah. And then in the middle of it all, RMS Trump is hitting an iceberg, and Australia needs to find a way to survive.
Yeah. And, you know, you and I have talked over the years of the iceberg under the surface, right? The financial system that is not fit for purpose, that has been engineered in a way that is actually not advantaging ordinary people. And, you know, you can now see even people's superannuation is at risk. And more broadly, this talks to the question of how we actually navigate our way through a new path. You know, we might have missed the immediate iceberg the other day, although I suspect we haven't. The truth is that this is symptomatic of a much broader set of issues. And actually, this election, to my mind, is a critical determinant point. You know, do we actually just continue to go with the status quo and say she'll be right? Or is it time to actually say, no, there's a different path that we can travel?
Well, exactly. There's a big comparison between what Trump has just done now and what early 2020 was like when COVID caused global supply chains to collapse. They came to a grinding halt, and countries were left completely at sea about how to deal with that. And in this case, this has been done by Trump's own ego, or he certainly thinks he's following a plan. But whatever that is, and I want to comment on that in a minute. I'm going to give him some credit, but I think some more criticism than credit. But whatever his plan is, that's in a sense irrelevant to Australia. Australia's got to think about, well, how does our economy actually work, and how can we ensure real, genuine stability in the form of a proper productive base that keeps serving us going forward. And that's where we're in real trouble, because what we have instead is a vulnerability to economic and financial forces that, you know, are unresolved, in many cases, unresolved problems from, you know, going back to 2008 and before, right? And so, you know, the example of that is this seems on the surface fundamentally a trade issue that Trump has triggered, a trade war. However, what caused his big backflip yesterday out of the blue, right? He's trying to make it out that he's won some kind of contest against China because 50 countries or something came, as he said, kissing his ass. He actually said that. They've come kissing his ass to do a deal. And China was the only country that didn't. And China said no, and China is matching him. And so Trump said, because they've kissed my ass, I'm going to do this. But the other side of the story, which is much more true, is that he nearly broke the whole global financial system. And you would know, you know, better than anybody how that works, right? And the bondholders were in crisis. The basis trade was totally blown out. And that's the sort of thing that surely, you and I didn't even plan this, to have this part of the discussion, but let me take the opportunity to throw a question at you. Surely logic says that was a much bigger reason for his change of heart, temporary change of heart, than any so-called kissing of his ass by 50 countries.
Yeah, Robbie, my perspective is this. Trump is trying to, after the event, say, oh, it was always planned, but actually he upset the bond markets dramatically. And it's interesting, we now know that it was actually Japanese bondholders that were actually selling. It wasn't Chinese, it was actually Japanese bondholders that actually precipitated the significant rise. Now, you know, in theory, bond prices effectively should have moved in the other direction, and that means that yield would have dropped because of what was happening with uncertainty. But what it's done is to highlight the fact that the financial markets are now worried that actually, you know, the basis of the financial system, the strong dollar, the treasuries, it is not as safe as it perhaps once was, and that's why rates are going up, and that was put pressure on. But the volatility was the other thing. There are a lot of financial players out of position. And what that means is that they've been forced to effectively pay margin calls, which means they need assets to do that, or indeed other problems, which means that the financial system, the financial plumbing was getting gummed up. And, you know, people were starting to draw comparisons between that and 2007, and would central banks have to intervene, except, of course, central banks this time around have high inflation as a big problem to start with. So that what it is doing, it's casting again a spotlight on the real problem, which is the massive amount of debt in the system, the fact that the financial system is not working as it should. It's highly leveraged. There's a lot of risk in the system, and that risk is coming to the surface. I'd also make the other point. Trump has a point that the way that the financial system and the broader economic system has played out has meant that there's been a hollowing out of effective production in country. And that's true in Australia, it's true in the US, it's true around the world. And that's because of this neoliberal view about, well, profit is everything, and you actually need to find the cheapest source internationally, despite the fact that, of course, in some countries, they have a much lower wages platform and potentially have a different regulatory environment within which they work. So there is a seed of truth in what he's saying, but what's happened is that the spotlight has now been turned on the stupidity of the financial system and the massive risk in the financial system. And by the way, the fact that the US is now proved to be a less reliable partner than many people. We were always saying, be careful, because, you know, US is not as reliable as you may think, and it's now proving all to be played out. And I've also got another point. I don't think Trump has precipitated this. I think Trump is a product of the system that's been running for the last 20 to 30 to 40 years in the US. So he's almost a product of the output rather than a creator of the input. And I think that's an important point to make as well.
No, I think that's true. Trump is America's id, screaming inside America's brain, you know, totally unfiltered. But it's actually part of this American, what the American economy has become. And he's just this angry reaction to it. But the problem is that there's a lot of self-delusion that goes on, because these people haven't thought a lot of these things through. They've thought some things through. They haven't thought a lot of these things through. And so, you know, when you delude yourself that the general consensus on how the markets are working may be true, and therefore, if I do this, this is going to have this effect, but you're not actually acknowledging what you and I have talked about for years, which is, you know, how post 2008, nothing was resolved, and we still have this cancer of derivatives in the system. And that kind of gambling, hyper speculation is based on assumptions that can't handle the kind of action that Trump has just taken. And if he had if anyone was paying attention to that beforehand, he might not have taken it. Right. He just thinks that what he's going to do is going to bring manufacturing back. He's focusing on that, and now he got a rude awakening. And then, of course, because he's Trump and he's a pretty transparent guy, you got a video of him in the White House with a couple of billionaire mates bragging about how much money they made when the markets took off again, when it went up. This is just, they're just openly bragging about insider trading. Yes. Nothing matters anymore, right? Poor old Gordon Gekko is probably still serving his jail sentence from the movie Wall Street, and he's looking around and going, "What the hell? What, you know? What about me?" Right? But where I do What I do want to say about Trump concretely, Martin, which is the reason for why we're talking about the lifeboat for Australia, because it's absolutely related. And this is something that our party and our organization has done a lot of work on, and we know the history. I remember when after Trump got elected this time, I did the same thing I did the first time, because I mostly the first time saw him as a joke, and then when he got elected, I thought, man, I better actually go and look at twice at the sort of things he was saying and what his platform was, etc. And I realized, well, hang on, now there is some substance in there, and there are things you can hear him talk sometimes where he focuses on one subject, and he actually, not when he's doing his MAGA rallies, but when he's actually talking in a certain format. So Joe Rogan was an example, and on Joe Rogan, he talked about tariffs. So he did a 3-hour interview with Joe Rogan. He talked about tariffs, and he talked about U.S. President William McKinley, and I could tell he'd read up on it or he'd been briefed on it in depth, right? So I thought, oh, okay. So this is not just a thought bubble for him. He's actually got into this because William McKinley was famous. He was assassinated eventually in 1900. But he was actually famous for presiding over a very high tariff regime in America. But he has this quote that is quite striking, because he talked about how at the time, the tax burden on Americans was so slight as to be almost imperceptible. That's actually how he put it. It was so slight as to be almost imperceptible, because the income tax didn't come until 1913. This is pre-1900, right? In the 1890s. Now, what he was meaning was the government's revenue came from tariffs, and so domestically in the United States, that was like water that just gradually got warmer. You're not this argument about tariffs puts up prices, and of course it does. But if you're already at that level where the tariffs are set and they've been set for a long time, et cetera, and that's just how your economy works, the government was raising plenty of revenue from tariffs, because this was Abraham Lincoln, and just before he died, launched the Transcontinental Railway Project in America in 1864. And to understand how transformative that was, that project, it cut down the travel time from New York to San Francisco went from something like 35 days, where you had to take a ship around the continent. It went from 35 days to 3 days. Now, that difference in that number, that's a productivity boom, a massive leap forward in productivity when you're actually transforming your country in that kind of way. And so that set up America for this massive boom, massive population increase from immigration. The population just soared. And in fact, the only thing that has matched America's boom from the 1860s until for the rest of the century, basically, has been China in our lifetime. Right? That's how transformative America was. So this was McKinley, and he was riding high on this high tariff regime. And Trump studied up on that clearly. However, he's also mentioned Alexander Hamilton. And Hamilton was the guy who sort of laid out the role of tariffs in the American system of political economy. And I call it the American system of political economy because that's what they called it, the American system of political economy. And McKinley was in that tradition that Hamilton started a century before him. But this is where Trump falls down, because he actually doesn't understand it. So when Alexander Hamilton, who is recognized by all fair-minded people as a real genius, he was George Washington's first Treasury Secretary. They had just defeated the greatest empire, in terms of land size, the world had ever spread around the world had ever seen, as 13 colonies. It was quite an accomplishment. And Hamilton's concern was, how do we win the peace, in a sense? What that's a modern term. He wouldn't have used that term, but that's essentially what it was. How do we actually hold this independence that we've got unless we have a strong economy? And so he developed what became known as the American system, because at the time, the dominant alternative system was known as the British system. And it was called that because it was essentially the market trading system of the British East India Company, right? That's what dominated the world. What the biggest monopoly in world history had tentacles absolutely everywhere. Every country under its control was turned into some kind of monoculture or mono producer of individual goods that were then shipped around the world. So, for instance, the British took India had a fantastic textile industry before the British got there. The British just destroyed it, and they made the Indians grow things like opium, a monoculture, and then they took the opium to China, right, to trade for tea. And then of course the emperor eventually cracked down on that because everyone in China got addicted to drugs, and so they said, well, no one tells us what to do. We're the British Empire, and they launched two wars against China for that. And they took, but the tea they took, they were selling in Europe, and they're also selling in the Americas. And of course the Americans famously dumped it in the Boston Harbor. But then at the same time they were getting textiles, the cotton from the Americas, to take to their textile factories in Manchester, right, where they did the British did the manufacturing for their empire, because that's where the real money was made. And those cotton farms in South America, in the southern states of America, they were manned by slaves that the British were trading from Africa, right? And this was the system. And it was a form of globalization, but with no real, where the participants had no real agency. And that's a big difference to today. We can talk about that in a minute. But it was the original globalization, what the East India Company did. And the Americans knew that no, they had to be essentially self-sufficient. That's what their goal was. So Hamilton came up with this American system, and it was high tariffs to foster and protect industries, not as punishment, but so that America could have its own industries, right? And raise revenue. The very first bill the American Congress passed was a tariff bill. And he part and then the second bill, and this was the second part of his platform, was for the National Bank. And this was Alexander Hamilton invented the concept of a national bank. He had to pass the tariff bill so that the public would know that the America's debt that was rolled into the National Bank, and it had a massive debt after the war, was going to be funded, but it could only be funded if the government raised taxes through tariffs, right? And so he created this National Bank for, and this was the third part, they called it the Internal Improvement System for investment in infrastructure. Things like the Erie Canal were eventually was a bit eventually built out of this kind of perspective. And to transform and uplift the American economy. That was the American system. It wasn't just tariffs. It was a well thought through system of looking at the economy as a whole and what it needed. And tariffs were an important part of it, but they weren't punitive. They were protective, and they were for fostering industry, right? They weren't punitive tariffs. Trump has got his eyes set on this one thing, tariffs, as if he may wave a magic wand and America's industries are going to come back. But I've been to some of those places, Martin, right? You go to Pittsburgh, you go to Detroit. These places they're not called the Rust Belt for nothing, right? You don't wave a magic wand and then, like something out of a Disney movie, all the little parts start coming back together again, and these factories magically become shiny again, and a whole horde of people walk in with their lunch pails and start banging on things just because you've raised tariffs. The delay, like you could have, it might eventually happen in some form. But the time delay is going to be quite significant. And that significant delay equals a huge amount of pain for the American people while they're waiting for that, right? So then the question becomes, well, what could, is there another way that Trump could achieve what he wanted? Well, go back to what I said about when he got elected in 2016. When I went and looked at his platform in 2016, I noticed something that made my heart sore because of our, interest in a national bank. In 2016, he actually campaigned on, as part of his platform, a national investment bank. That's what it was in his platform. But it was a token thing. It was just there for show. But what if he actually uses that, and I got friends over in America that are pushing for a national infrastructure bank. That could be capitalized with US Federal Reserve existing bonds and could be a $5 trillion bank, right? What could he do? Now, I've just done a segment of our show on this, and I just want to repeat what I've suggested. Think what he could have done instead. So here's an idea. How about finally embarking on a transformative project such as high-speed rail for the United States? Now, unlike Australia, US does have a pretty high population density, right? It has zero high-speed rail. And, you know, they've just left it up to the market, and the market doesn't provide. China did not build its high-speed rail, 50,000 kilometers of high-speed rail, by leaving up to the market. It now has this massively impressive high-speed rail system using our iron ore, because the Chinese government uses state banks to fund this kind of infrastructure. And that's what Donald Trump could be doing. And the steel could be coming from American steel mills. And there'll be all sorts of other industries that would be popping up around that activity. What he would be doing is increasing net aggregate demand of steel for the whole world, right? So he wouldn't be undermining other steel markets. Just, you know, and he'll still, actually at the beginning, he'll have to import a whole bunch of steel because they wouldn't be able to produce the quantity in the United States, but they could scale that up. They could actually have the confidence and make the investments and scale it up and get the investments from the National Infrastructure Bank to do it, right? That's the kind of thing. And then you've done something big to get your industries back around creating something new, whereas that's not how Trump's thinking. How he's thinking is, we don't have it, China's got it, and in his zero-sum game world, China must have stolen it. And even though I fundamentally agree with what you said about he's not wrong on some of the framework of this, where he's dead wrong is the way he is, his political language about it. China has raped America. No country can come to a country like America or Australia and steal our industries from us. We outsourced them. Wall Street outsourced them. But you know, when they outsourced to America, Martin, these arrogant white bastards, and that's what it was, they were white supremacists, because they looked at those Chinese and they thought, oh, these fools, we'll just take advantage of their cheap labor. And Deng Xiaoping said, yes, 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 please come in, but we're going to have an agreement. And the agreement is, everything you do, when you outsource to us, it's a joint venture. And that joint venture is majority Chinese owned, and you transfer the technology. It was in the agreement from the beginning. Nowadays, we call that technology theft. No, it was crap. They couldn't do it fast enough back in the 1990s. It was in the, they were tripping over themselves. Wall Street couldn't outsource fast enough. They just signed everything because China's no mugs. It did not intend to be a cheap labor economy forever. And it's not anymore. And Donald Trump doesn't even know that. Stupid Vance, the other 2 days ago, insulted the Chinese by calling them things made by Chinese peasants. Have you been there, mate? They're not peasants. They are the most sophisticated advanced manufacturers in the world. And Biden spent 4 years trying to cut them off at the kneecaps by stopping, you know, the Taiwanese from shipping chips to them, semiconductors to them, etc. And they just regrouped and they found another way to make their own product better. They're not peasants at all. This is a 5,000-year-old civilization that before the white people got there, between India and China, they were 50% of the world GDP. They are not inferior in any way to the West. Get that out of your head, Western people. They are not inferior, but they went through a century of what they call humiliation after they lost the Opium War. And they're back, baby. And they see themselves as a 5,000-year-old civilization. And so now they're genuinely back. They're strong. They're much stronger than back in 2018. Because in 2018, when Trump tried this garbage, China did a deal with Trump, agreed to $200 billion more imports from America. Remember? And then this time, though, China's gone, sorry, mate, doesn't work with us anymore. You are not, you can be a bully as much as you like. We're the one guy in the schoolyard you can't push around. And this is what Trump and the people behind him haven't understood yet. And so they're plowing ahead with RMS Trump heading towards the iceberg, and we're yet to see how this fully plays out. And the only thing we can hope is there's one element of this where, as we saw, I do sometimes cling for hope, Martin, to the North Korea precedent. Because the North Korea precedent was Trump was terrifying in 2018, hellfire and brimstone on North Korea. But as soon as Kim Jong-un did the deal he wanted, he was the nicest guy in the world. He brought North Korea in from the cold, right? He pissed off most of his country. Oh, you're giving the regime legitimacy, blah, 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 which pissed me off because that's the sort of arrogant garbage that's just none of people's business. North Korea is a legitimate country, and it's the West doesn't get to define what's a legitimate country or not. And Trump said, no, he started saying nice things about Kim Jong-un. So, he'd be looking for a deal with China, but he's going to have to, I think, adjust his assumptions about China, because this is not going to happen that easily. And in the meantime, though, I think we need to, and I'd be interested in your comment, but, I think Australia, I want to talk next about what Australia needs to do, regardless of what Trump does.
Well, there's so much there to unpack, and, we don't want to go on forever, but three quick points. The first point is, if you actually looked at the calculations that were done, when he held up those cards, and everybody said, well, where'd you get the numbers from, right? And then they sort of published this, wanky, wobbly formula that actually was completely made up as well. Interestingly, the professors who wrote the paper that actually underpinned it said some quite interesting things. One is they didn't understand his paper in the first place. Secondly, the quantum of the tariffs that they actually came up with were about 10 times what they should have been to be able to actually maximize the impact, right? And the third thing, of course, is they've walked away from most of it other than for China. So the foundational mathematics that they actually held up was just there for effect. It wasn't really that meaningful. I think that's the first point. The second point, when you actually think that Norfolk Island and some penguins in, the South Atlantic.
McDonald and Heard Island, which we'd never heard of before, but somehow the White House had.
It shows you just how, crazy the whole thing was. And by the way, they've excluded completely services, right? So there's only goods. There's a very small part. So this is the first point. So the basic math doesn't work. The second point is that if you actually bring manufacturing back, you're not going to bring back lots of jobs for a lot of workers necessarily, right? No. Because the thing about China that people understand, it's highly automated, it's highly sophisticated. They've got robots doing massive amounts of the manufacturing. That's why they can do it at the price they can do it, and with the effect. So the sorts of jobs that are going to be created if they do bring jobs back on shore, won't be what they think it was. It's not the 1950s again, right? It's not the 1920s. No. Third point, if you go back in history and look at when those tariffs were actually introduced, so a century ago and then the 1930s, it led to depression.
Yes.
Because, again, they weren't thinking about holistically. They weren't understanding how all of these mechanisms were actually intertwined with other things. And, ever more so now because of the international structure that we've got and because of the international finance. So there are so many points at which...
And I think, hang on, your last point. I think, and the Panama Canal had something to do with the 1890s depression as well.
Similar problem, right?
Yeah. History doesn't repeat, it rhymes.
Yeah. Now... My take out all of this is Pax Americana is dead, right? So the whole concept of you build the whole world order based on what the US order is, and everybody follows that, and the US is going to be the global world peacekeeper and will always be there, and everyone will watch your back, especially if you're Western countries. That's all gone, right? And I don't think that will ever be recoverable, and that's a really uncomfortable observation for Australia. The second is Australia is uniquely exposed to what's going on at the moment because of its footprint with China on a trade axis and with the US on its defense and, sociological aligned axis. So they're really caught. I've said on several occasions, Australia is caught doing the splits, right? because effectively these two land masses are going in very different directions metaphorically. As a result of that, Australia cannot straddle the way they tried to straddle previously. And so we've got to actually stand up for ourselves a little bit more and understand that actually Australia has the opportunity and potential to plow its own path rather than just being captured by, you know, the defense establishment in the US or the trade alignment with China. And that's a very important point. I don't hear that in the election campaign at all from the major parties, right? It's like they mess around the edge, but they don't really touch that. The final observation is that the 90 days, you know, that's not the end of the story. This is just a little interim, right? And you know, we don't know what will be negotiated or what won't be. But it's not like this is going to suddenly get fixed, because the trajectory that Trump has set himself on with, well, frankly, the sycophants that he actually had around him, right? By the way, they don't necessarily all agree with each other. You know, some believe it should be a permanent state. Others think it should be a state of negotiation. So even within the Trump camp, there's not clarity. But the point is, this is not going to get fixed in the next week or two, which means that the financial system is going to go through its continued eruptions for weeks and months. Now, I want to remind everybody, in a bear market, what you see is massive ups and massive downs, massive ups and massive downs. We see high volatility. Now look at the volatility index now. It's signaling high volatility. So we are in this realm of uncertainty. And I think, for my mind, that perspective of global uncertainty, global financial instability, etc., comes right back to the discussion we should be having for the election campaign in Australia and the policies that should be on the table in the election that's coming up to early May.
Yep. And that's where I come in, because this is exactly what we're trying to do. And unfortunately, Martin, you're the only channel that gives it this kind of discussion a platform. So thank you for that. Before, I want to talk about the lifeboat now and the Australian side of it, but I did, based on what you just said, I don't want to scare people, but I do. If one thing people should be afraid about is that, you know, when you're wondering what Trump's going to do in the next 90 days or in the next week, you got to understand who one of his advisors is. There's a certifiable lunatic in the White House who is Donald Trump's number one trade advisor. And I want to ram this home because of just, we were joking about it, but you know, Norfolk Island and McDonald and Heard Island, this and the formula for the tariffs, this was the height of incompetence. You know, we grew up being told that the president of the United States is the leader of the so-called free world, whatever that was supposed to mean. And in the White House is like, you know, these people you would assume are the smartest people on earth, right? And they produce a rationale for this tariff decision that's so incompetent. Well, I'm not blaming Trump for this. I mean, he can't do all the sums himself, right? He has to think the global stuff. The guy I'm talking about, his name is Peter Navarro, and I have hated this guy with a passion. I've despised him for 8 years when I found out about him. And the reason why is there was three people that in the first Trump administration that are most to blame for screwing, for turning America on this hard turn towards a conflict with China. And Australia went along with it in its wake, and it's been chaos here ever since. And we had all our trade troubles as well. But in the first Trump administration, everyone in Australia gave this guy credit. His name was Peter Navarro. The other two at the time were Mike Pompeo and John Bolton. Neither of those warmongering bastards got a gig in this new Trump administration. That made me positive at first. But the third guy, Navarro, did. And I remember him from the first time. And, you know, he was quoted in the media a lot about, always whipping up hysteria about China. People gave him credibility. Well, for every Australian who's now really freaked out about what Trump's doing about tariffs, well, this is your guy. Look at the real face of this guy. Because not only is he an absolutely demented Sinophobe when it comes to China, he's the guy that's put China in Trump's head, right? As China, China, China. China's stealing from us. China's raping us. This is all Peter Navarro. But he's a damn fraudster. He's written books, and this was discovered by an academic at ANU a few years ago, where you read the book and he's got all this, it's always these attacks on China, but He has an expert he keeps quoting named Ron Vara, who has all this blood-curdling quotes about China. And it's just really horrible stuff about, you know, Chinese eat babies for breakfast, that kind of stuff, right? Like you've got to see them as monstrous and less than human. That's what he's trying to protect in his books. The guy is an utter racist pig, but he's a fraudster because he attributes these quotes to this guy, Ron Vara, except there is no such person exists. That's an anagram of his own name. These are his own twisted views that he attributes to this guy. And he's the one who did the sums for Trump. And so if you've lost thousands of dollars in your super because of what's happened last week, this is the guy behind it. His name's Peter Navarro, and he did it because he despises China so much. And if you think Robbie Barwick is off his rocker because I'm always defending China, well, enjoy losing your thousands of dollars because you're going to follow idiots like this, right? These people are flushing the world economy down the toilet because they're so twisted with hate for the, there's no reason for it. The very fact that in the first Trump administration, Trump did his muscle up thing to China again on trade, but China came to the table and agreed to an extra $200 billion shows they are prepared to negotiate in good faith. What they won't be do is won't take is being steamrolled and bullied, right? And this is enough is enough. And I can't tell you how bad this guy is in the White House. But anyway, so just bear that in mind because he's still there and he's giving Trump advice over the next 90 days. So hang on to your hats. What can we do?
Hang on. Before you just go
sorry,
on.
Sorry. Okay, sorry.
Yeah, one point. Navarro is quite interesting because he was the one advocating these additional reciprocal tariffs and that all that modeling, right? There were other people within the White House, it appears, who wanted the 10% baseline as a sort of a, you know, a negotiation point. And it goes back to this fundamental question. Are the tariffs about negotiating, in other words, doing other things and wheeling and dealing, you know, the art of the deal? And it's funny how now everyone's rolling, oh, it was the art of the deal, et cetera, right? Navarro was not on the art of the deal path at all, right? He was wired completely differently, as you say. It's a consistent pattern. And so actually within the Trump camp, you've got this contention between these two views, right? And my sense is...
People might know Elon Musk has had a very public war of words with Peter Navarro.
Absolutely. You took the words out of my mouth. Exactly right. So it's quite interesting that actually, you know, there is not... Yep. So my point is there is not coherence within inside the White House as to what this Trump strategy and what the tariff strategy is all about, right? Different people have different views, different angles. The difference this time is that there were no checks and balances like last time. So last time Trump, you know, did thought bubbles, but actually people in the White House said yes, but then did no, right? This time, unfortunately, those thought bubbles and those sort of, you know, those issues get enacted simply because we don't have the same checks and balances. Yeah. The point is, don't expect the uncertainty to go away, which then comes directly back to, in the light of all that, that's why what we do in Australia and at this election becomes so critical.
100%. So you can take, let's contrast two approaches. One approach happened last Friday where Peter Dutton and Anthony Albanese raced each other literally to announce that they're going to cancel the lease on the Port of Darwin because it's leased to a Chinese company. Now, I have to confess, my first thought was, okay, these guys, there's been such an anti-China hysteria flavor to the election so far. They're just in full dog whistling mode and they're just grabbing everything they can to look like they're tough on China. Actually, I'm now convinced that that's not what happened. They're so desperate to suck up to the white, find a way to suck up to Trump about these tariffs. They got the message from the United States, reverse that sale. That reversed that lease to the port of Darwin. And even though every national security assessment has said there is no security issue at that port whatsoever, as I'm at pains to say, we would never privatize it if we're the Citizens Party in government because we don't believe in privatization. We believe government should own assets and use them to serve the people. But anyway, they did, and they actually got a pretty good deal about it at the time. And the port has been upgraded and Darwin has more activity now thanks to the upgrading of that port by this land bridge company. But the Americans always opposed it from Obama, even before Trump, they always opposed it. And so now They found a way to get the message to our government, reverse that. And like the sycophantic lapdogs they are, they quickly jump to do it. And what this does at the worst possible time is undermine to Asians, not just Chinese, but to Asians, the integrity of foreign investment in Australia. Right? It's a real issue. But anyway, so that's one approach. What's the other approach? Well, back in 2020, Martin, you and I, we would have had a whole bunch of conversations on this. When COVID hit, we went really big and we put out a statement saying what Australia desperately needs is what I said Donald Trump should have implemented in 2016 when he campaigned up. We need a national development bank. And there's two areas where it's actually quite urgent. I consulted some experts on finance and investment and balance of payments and stuff, and they helped. We had some interesting discussions about this and to help it, you know, congeal in my mind. Think of it this way. There's a whole bunch of industries in Australia that have made investment decisions, long-term investment decisions, based on the settings of the global trade system before Donald Trump did this. And all those settings are gone now, right? He's pulled the rug out from under them all. And so what were viable investments are now extremely questionable, right? Now, do we sit back and let those investments be lost? These are actual industrial investments. Do we just sit back and let them be lost? Well, that would be insane. This is the idea. If you just so worship the free market that anything that happens, you're just going to have to let companies just adapt to or die. Well, you know, you're going to rule out. You're not paying attention to how the universe really works, because sometimes these big things happen, and there are times when there is definitely a role for the government, knowing that industries can be strategic in many different senses of strategic. Right. Sometimes they're strategic because they're part of, if you don't have industries, you don't have a defense capability. Sometimes they're strategic because if you don't have those industries, you don't have the ability to feed yourself and clothe yourself, you know, like those sort of things. So what do we do? Well, if you have a national development bank, what you have is a capability to be able to deploy patient capital that's not seeking a massive return, a maximum return now in the shortest possible time, but it's patient capital that can tide over these industries and help them to go through what is going to be a transition period and keep them on their feet, right? And you're not, the CBA is not going to pony up this money, right? Citibank's not going to put up this money. You need a form of patient capital, because you may not get a return for a while. Likewise, there's actually, it's time again to think, well, you know, we do need more of our own industries in Australia. We don't have to think in terms of, oh, we've got to be totally self-sufficient and cut out the rest of the world. No, that's silly. You don't have to think that way, but you've got to have a capacity at least that can be scalable and adaptable and just some of your own ideas. Let's just have our own. Let's start being a country that takes advantage of its own, the genius of its own people, of which we've got lots. But this is a country where there is a whole library full of examples of Australian inventions that got poached overseas because they wouldn't be backed in Australia, right? We've got to start backing our own industries and ideas in Australia. And again, CBA is not going to do it. Westpac's not going to do it. I mean, we have given total control of credit in Australia over to a private banking cartel. And they're not interested in anything long-term and anything that's actually productive. They want to maximize their returns in the short term now. So we got to go back to a model that we used to use very well, which is a government or a national development bank. And that's what it could be doing now. And this is not just Trump again is just the latest catalyst. This was always necessary, right? COVID was a catalyst. Trump was a catalyst. And then you think, well, you know, oh, you know, well, you know, is that really necessary? You know, surely the market should be able to do it or whatever. You know, government, you know, is it really the role of government to do that? Well, we have a system in Australia where they don't hesitate when it comes to doing these kinds of things to prop up the private banks as we did in COVID, with both QE, but also this $180 billion term funding facility that the Reserve Bank conjured up and lent to the private banks. And they were supposed to on-lend it to small business, but they didn't. And instead, they just it just gave them this free income of about $5 billion a year each that they added to their not each $5 billion a year total that they added to their bottom line at a minimum, and $180 billion. I mean, that's a huge amount of money. You know what I'm talking about wouldn't even be that much money, but it would be a lot more than Anthony Albanese is talking about, because Anthony, we have this thing called the National Reconstruction Fund in Australia that Albanese set up, which is a $15 billion fund, but it's not a bank, it's just a fund. And Albo's made two announcements now that are in this direction, but give you the sense of difference is one announcement is for $50 million to assist industry to adjust, and one is for $1 billion to assist finding new markets. $1 billion and $50. I'm talking about setting up a development bank that can pump out tens of billions of dollars, over $100 billion if it's necessary, that you could invite the super funds that are now invested overseas for some reason. They could invest in bonds in this thing and have reliable income for themselves that's guaranteed by the government, right? And stability on that front while their capital is being put to use in Australia as well. Actually building up our country's capacity. That's what I'm talking about. I think we talked about this in COVID. Donald Trump's come along and is a one-man virus on the world. But look, Australia, when are we going to get the picture? Let's get our own economy back on track so you can survive whatever's thrown. Because what's next? Well, I'll tell you the other thing that could happen that you can't rule out that would be even more disruptive than anything so far, than a pandemic or Donald Trump, and that's war, right? And then we'll have the same conversation again. When are we going to do it? So the Citizens Party, of course, our number one campaign platform is for a public bank. Well, the way we see it is it'll have a retail arm in post offices, right? That's the post office bank, the Aussie Post Bank. But it could also be a development bank where even the savings of the people who bank with the post office bank will be invested in industry and infrastructure in Australia.
Yeah, and in the current environment where, of course, the financial system is under duress again, and the derivatives exposures mean that we don't quite know what's going on under the hood in the inside the banking system. We've still got the bail-in, of course, of deposits as a risk in the background in our minds in Australia. So having an entity that is actually focused on the investment of the future of Australia, and one where individuals can actually put their funds safely and know that it's not going to disappear is very attractive. And the fact that we are our own masters, because the thing that I am noticing more and more at the moment is that when you have to go to cap in hand to the big US investors, they will run a ruler over projects on a particular way for particular purposes. So you can't necessarily get the things done that you should be getting done. And the other point I'd make, Robbie, is that patient capital means, because it takes a long time to get some of these things done, right? It's not about the maximizing return in the short term. It's not just about the NPV calculation. It's about strategic rebuild of society and the community. Why? Because the infrastructure that we need in Australia has not been built for a generation or two. We've just not been building the right stuff in the right place for the right outcomes. And just take an example. The housing estates around the place where people on the outskirts of Sydney and Melbourne have no infrastructure, right? So they have to drive a lot further. They have to pay bigger tolls to get about, clip the ticket every time you move, frankly. This whole philosophy, which of course goes right back to what we talk about neoliberalism, let the markets be the markets, don't intervene, charge as much as you can. It's about profit maximization. Now, this is the wrong set of philosophical points to build a community and a society for the future, which is why this is so critical. And I'm just really shocked at how badly the election campaign is going at the moment, because none of this strategic stuff is being discussed. It's all about, we'll give you a some money over here so we can you can put a battery on your house, or we'll take this amount off your fuel excise because that'll make things a bit easier, or we'll give you a bit more money for your electricity. I mean, none of this is laying the foundation for a strategic future for Australia, for the country. And I don't understand why people just don't get that there is a much more strategic conversation that we should be having. And by the way, just picking up our earlier conversation, I've just noticed that China's increased their tariffs on the US to 125%. All right. And Victor Gao, I want to quote, we don't care about losing the US market. The world is big enough and the US is not the totality of the market. China has been here for 5,000 years. Most of that time, there was no US, and we'll survive another 5,000 years without them, right? So if anybody thinks that China is going to blink and effectively we're going to go back to where we were, you know, a few months ago, forget it. We're actually now approaching a new game, and Australia needs to stand up for itself. And that means that we need a set of policies that are strategic in nature and are tackling some of those critical issues. And by the way, that bank, the People's Bank, could be a solution to the housing situation too, in terms of mortgage finance and the price of mortgages, and could actually support the construction of a significantly accelerated building scheme in Australia. So there are so many things it could do. So for me, this becomes the strategic imperative, and this is what we should be talking about in this election campaign.
Yep. Well, we are, and thanks to you, we get to talk about it on your channel as well. So the election's on the 3rd of May. The Citizens Party has a straightforward platform with two main planks, a lot of detailed policies, but a public bank and an independent foreign policy, so that we are not, when we make our decisions about what we're going to do, it's not out of this subservience to the Yanks or the Brits. We truly think independently about what's in our interest. And the public bank is so important because it addresses so many things. And what I would say in conclusion, Martin, to your viewers, you know, everyone's thinking about how you're going to vote. Where there is a record minor party or non-major party vote, this is probably going to break the record. I'm looking at all these polls where they keep saying the soft vote, they call it, which is the vote not committed to the two major parties, is at record highs. So it could be 40% this year. And it was even true last time, where more people voted against the major parties than for either of the major parties, right? Problem is, the media coverage of the election isn't reflecting that. It's all as if Dutton and Albanese are the only game in town, whereas they are actually a minority now in terms of how it's played. So the thing with the Citizens Party, here's a little pitch in ending. When you think about the Citizens Party in this election, you may be lucky enough to have a candidate in your House of Representative seat, but we're only running a handful of those. We are covering the Senate, though, in every state, and we've got some very high-powered senators, none more so than Dr. Andy Schmuller, who was on your live show a couple of weeks ago. And everyone, I mean, your live show was brilliant in launching Andy's to the public consciousness, but he's really striking a chord around the place. And so the thing to think about is, at the end of this election, there's going to be a crossbench in the Senate. Labor won't have the majority. Liberals won't have the majority. No, neither party have had a majority for years. So there's going to be a crossbench there. Who do you want in that crossbench? And when you think of the Citizens Party, we have a record you can look at. And it's all here on Martin North's channel. But since 2018, we've covered all our big campaigns where we have done so much work in Parliament to force the government to address the economic harm inflicted upon Australia by the banks in all sorts of ways, including the housing market, including predatory banking practices that created hundreds of thousands of bank victims, including the drive to cashlessness and the cash ban, including closing down bank branches and withdrawing financial services from people, right? And we have been driving that. And parallel to us, before we got to work with Andy as our candidate, he was doing the same thing by taking on Coles and Woolworths and taking on PwC and taking on the banks in Senate inquiries as well, right? That is our record. We've done it really well. Put us into the Senate crossbench and we'll do it into the balance of power, and we'll do it even more effectively, right? And then we can use that leverage to start forcing the parties to actually take up these issues. And that's the power you have. So that's my appeal, people. I'm the Senate candidate for Victoria, Andy Schmulo in New South Wales. Look up our website, citizensparty.org.au, Aisha Novakovic in Western Australia. We will not be seat warmers in the Senate, and look at our record to see for the confidence you'll need to vote for us.
And Robbie, just to extend this into a slight coda, just want to highlight that legislation was agreed between the two major parties before the election was announced, making it harder for small parties to be able to actually fund themselves.
Yep.
Ask yourself why they did that. They did that because they are absolutely scared of what's happening in minor party land. And this is now a critical linchpin and the lynch turning point potentially for the political environment within Australia, right? This election is so critical. And, I always say to people, don't just do what you've always done and vote for who you've always voted for. Do the work, do the research, look at what actually is there, and look at what you can do to have your vote actually really making a difference. And the minor party vote, to my mind, is the critical secret sauce here to show that the two major parties just can't deal away and, say, well, we're going back 20 years. This election is probably the most critical of the century.
Yep. So bear that in mind, people, when you go to vote, because it's time to address these big issues. And, we can't just allow ourselves to get distracted on things that aren't as important. The reason we focus on the banks is because when it comes to the economy, that's where all the problems start. That's where all the solutions can start as well.
Robbie, thank you very much. Best of luck with the campaign for the next 2 or 3 weeks. I'm sure you'll get some sleep in 4 weeks' time. But keep batting, and I'll look forward to catching up with you.
Thanks,
down the track. Take care. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.